This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 28th of September. I'm Melissa Idris and I've got a full house in the studio here with me, Brian Fernandez and Joyce Go. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
In unison. Macam sekolah lah. Selamat pagi, cikgu.
We're still young, you know. So macam sekolah lah.
All right. Well, let's kick things off with a look at what's coming up on the show today. On the Breakfast Grill at 8 o'clock, we have one of the world's leading economists of inequality, Branko Milanović, author of the groundbreaking book, Global Inequality, A New Approach. Now, the central question of Branko's book is, who has gained from globalization? And essentially, this is a book that has won worldwide acclaim. It essentially is known for that elephant chart. If you've seen that, the chart that looks at inequality over time, it's in the shape of an elephant. And Branko takes a look at who has won from globalization and who has lost relatively.
So that would be an interesting conversation, I'm sure, when you have it on the grill, because really the arguments for many people is that globalization has really just benefited the rich. And income inequality, particularly within nations itself, has widened dramatically, and none so than the United States.
I think that's a fascinating point because, yes, income inequality, intra-country income inequality has increased. So within one country, you will see the divide between the haves and the have-nots. But if you look at global inequality, it has gone down. So inequality between countries, for instance, Malaysia and the US, has gone down tremendously. And that's because of the rise of China and India.
Yes, and I think it also, with globalization, it helps people that you can go overseas to work and perhaps get better income from earning where you are
exactly.
Currently staying.
So
right?
Freedom of movement there. So more on that on the Breakfast Grill as we speak to one of the leading economists of inequality, Branko Milanović. And just before the 8 o'clock news, so just before the Breakfast Grill, we have our weekly InvestSmart SC series. Now, today we're going to be looking at investing in stocks. We also have a Twitter poll going ahead of this series. And the question we're asking today is, do you invest in stocks? So the options are, yes, I do. No, I prefer other asset classes. Or no, I'd rather use that money to go on holidays. I know what I would answer. I do, but to be completely honest with you, I would prefer other asset classes because stocks is just a small part of my portfolio. What about you guys?
Well, the thing is, I used to invest in stocks and got burnt very badly in 1997. After that, have not invested at all. However, this year, I already started to plan to invest in stocks. So what I did was I have been equipping myself, thanks to BFM, of course, of all the knowledge, and I'm just about to start reinvesting again in stocks.
Well, I personally prefer other asset classes because, I don't know, I feel investing in stocks, it depends because we're business journalists, right? So sometimes the regulators might,
sure, I mean, you have that conflict of interest.
Yeah, so we have to look into that. But also, I understand. I think younger people nowadays, so not a lot of them are investing into stocks, but it depends on whether they understand it or not.
Yeah,
so
you need to understand what you're,
what you're investing into.
And also, I think that one of the things with young people is the fact that the awareness of investing in stocks was not there, like, say, as much as 20 years ago. 20 years ago, aunties and uncles, whether it's a hawker or whether it's a banker, everyone was in the stock market.
Okay, well, that's our Twitter poll going. Tell us what you think, whether you do invest in stocks. And we know that investing in stocks can be tricky business. So you can master the basics with the Invest Smart series at 7:55 a.m. today. But if you're already a master in investing stocks, don't miss today's Ringgit and Cents because we have Mark Tier, author of the book How to Spot the Next Starbucks, Whole Foods, Walmart or McDonald's before its shares explode. That's at 9:30 a.m. today. And don't worry if you miss it because you can download that podcast anytime. You can just download the BFM app and listen to that interview. It's 5 minutes past six now, and after this, we dive into the world of art, specifically the Guggenheim's controversial animal art exhibit, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. The Joker there by Steve Miliband. I love the last line of that song. Really love your peaches, want to shake your tree. Some lighthearted tunes for you this morning. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Go and Brian Fernandez on The Morning Run. It's 9 minutes past 6 o'clock and we're looking at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. Why? Because it's caught up in some controversy for planning an exhibit called Art and China After 1989. So in this exhibit, there are several art installations that are said to feature circumstances of cruelty against animals in the name of art. So I'm going to give you an example of what these exhibitions are. Essentially, it's a video installation. So there's one installation which shows a recording of a live art performance. And I use art performance in air quotes because it's many critics are saying it's not really art. So it's a... They had four pairs of American pit bulls tethered to treadmills. And the dogs then are kind of facing each other, facing off against one another, running at one another, but never really touching because they're on treadmills and they're being tied back. So the video has close-up shots of the dogs kind of foaming at the mouth, really frantic, looking really distressed. Now, animal rights activists are saying that this is cruelty because it's stressful and frustrating for these animals who are trained to fight. So they're trying to fight, but they're being held back. Now, the Guggenheim wants to air this video as part of an art installation. So the question really is this too far for art? Does this count as animal cruelty?
Okay. On one hand, as an animal lover, I'm just appalled. But let's take the alternative point of view and let me give a different perspective. Art is always about provoking responses. Art is always about broadening your horizons. Artists want to draw attention to things and sometimes do controversial things to draw attention to issues that need to be highlighted. So we need to give them space sometimes to highlight these issues.
Yeah, but I think art is subjective. But when you say that it's to provoke, sometimes art is you can enjoy the piece of art, but it doesn't need to provoke you. I find so it could be subjective. But at the end of the day, for me, I feel that's a bit too far. I mean, how far do you go? I mean, yes, there's this whole freedom of expression. There's this whole you want to be arty and all that. But then again, these are animals.
Right, yeah. So yes, art is perhaps there to provoke an emotional response, any kind of response, good or bad. But how far does it push someone's buttons? And I have to say, different people viewing this will feel it differently, right? Because, you know, again, like you said, art is subjective. So maybe... Brian, you as an animal lover will be completely offended at this, but someone else looking at it will be like, oh, that's an interesting commentary on kind of social dynamics.
You see, so think of the audiences that it reaches. So as an animal lover, what this is basically it's about dog fighting and animals getting together, the aggression, holding them back, and then they literally tear each other apart.
I think it was a commentary on the superpowers of the world trying to kind of get at each other but never really getting at each other.
But think of it, for me as an artist, and I'm appalled by this, I want to draw attention to this to a completely different audience. Guggenheim is an amazing way, for example, to draw attention to this problem.
Yeah, so the Guggenheim has said that the exhibit is an intentionally challenging and provocative piece. So they want people to come and have discussions like exactly what we're having right now. But what happened was they started receiving threats of violence, threats of arson. So they said, okay, well, given the new developments, we're going to pull this exhibit. So again, I don't know whether this is the right thing that critics of this weren't able to have a proper discussion and resorted to violence, right?
Exactly. So then, like we've been discussing, where do we draw the line with expression?
Mm.
Now,
yeah.
In this case,
how far is too far?
Yes, how
far
is too far? If I'm the artist who is the animal lover and wants to draw attention to this and wants this exhibition to go ahead, then the whole purpose of having of me setting up this artwork or this exhibition is defeated.
Yeah, because I do think that art doesn't excuse you from morality. Just because something is said to be an art piece, it doesn't excuse you from moral consideration. So if I murdered someone for, you know, an art installation, I'm still a murderer, no matter what. Morality.
In the eyes of the law, of course.
Far, right? Yeah, exactly. So it's like, how far? This is kind of taking it too far.
I think I'd have to agree. Yeah. Animal cruelty has no place in art. But tell us what you think. Did you think that the Guggenheim did the right thing by pulling this controversial exhibition? So you can tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. I'm going to repeat myself, 018-789-8899. It's coming up to 6:15, and after this, we'll discuss the country that was named the most unhealthy in the world. What country do you think it is? Find out on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Melissa, Brian and Joyce here with you. It's The Morning Run, 6:19 on the clock, and that was Lucky Girl by Phaser Days. According to new research by a clinic comparison website called Clinic Compare, the least healthy country in the world is no drum roll, but okay, the Czech Republic. So apparently, research gathered from data from the World Health Organization analyzed alcoholic consumption, tobacco consumption, and the prevalence of obesity in 179 countries around the world, and found that residents of the Czech Republic was the most unhealthy in the world because some of them, it turns out that the Czech Republic is the world's biggest boozer. If I can give you some examples, each individual reportedly consumes 13.7 liters of alcohol per annum. And that works out to be 550 shots. So about a shot and a half a day. There you go.
No, but the thing is, I'm not surprised by that, whether it's the Czech Republic or Russia and so forth. So it brings me back to my first visit to Eastern Europe many years ago.
Oh, you've been before?
Yeah, I've actually been to somewhere Malaysians probably never even heard of, Moldova. And in Moldova, for example, people start the day literally with shots of vodka. So it's a really unhealthy, I mean, when you go behind, and the first trip was 1996, so a long time ago, people smoke and drink, you know, like it's going out of fashion. It's just part of having breakfast.
Well, starting the day with a shot of vodka would make for a very different morning run show.
That's right.
Not me personally, but that would definitely not fly in Malaysia for sure.
Actually, Brian, you mentioned Russia. Russia is number two. In this study, right?
Okay. Yeah. Is it because of the alcohol consumption that pushes these countries up?
Maybe it's the culture there, perhaps the weather. Perhaps they're drinking that because they're
cold,
right? Yeah,
absolutely. So there's a practical, Joyce, right. You're spot on. There's a practical reason for doing that. Yes, the men are smelling of vodka in the morning, particularly the men, unfortunately. But you're right. It's about keeping warm, right?
Yeah, it's part of the culture there as well. And where's Malaysia in all of this?
I have no idea.
I think they if we look at it, the map. No, it's there. But I think we're not that unhealthy according to them.
Okay, despite all our nasi lemak in the
morning. Yeah, we're towards the least unhealthy kind of culture. So, yeah.
Okay, all right. Let's take a look at what the healthiest country is. It's Afghanistan, because it has the second lowest rate of obesity in the world. Also, and the population, only 2.7% of the population has a BMI over 30. I don't know whether that is because, I mean, I don't think that's something that's necessarily to shout about them. It's not the healthiest. I think it's just perhaps a lack of opportunity of fast foods like we have of other foods, right?
Yeah, you've also got to look at the methodology of this. What are they using as a guide and a methodology to determine this? Is it just alcohol and tobacco consumption?
Yeah, I think they've got three things.
Tobacco and obesity. So that's our diets, right? So really, I mean, it's quite interesting. Afghanistan probably considered the healthiest because of the prohibition on alcohol, because perhaps the lack of access to tobacco products and you know, the diet is not as Western fast food friendly as the rest of the world.
And also the climate then. The climate, the fact that people probably are more outdoors, the climate lends itself to an opportunity. So this is why potentially then they would be healthy. Malaysians, on the other hand, one of the things that we have that's probably on the unhealthy scale is the fact that some 3.5 million Malaysians, this is a 2015 survey, are diabetics. So we're the fourth highest number of diabetics in Asia, which is quite a lot.
Yeah, it's a bit of a first world problem now that's becoming kind of a this age. We're seeing a lot of this these diseases come about. And I think as a country, are we really thinking about what it means to be healthy? I know most of us are more aware now, perhaps, you know, cut down on the sugar and the condensed milk in your teh tarik in the morning. But as overall, you have to admit that, you know, we're not really the healthiest of nations.
But I think, yeah, if you eat too well, perhaps this is like you say, Melissa, you eat too well and then it's all coming back to yes. haunt us, right? But I guess now we're all looking at exercising as well. Like corporates, they try and encourage their workers to exercise. They have a gym in the office, or you have people like cycling to work sometimes.
Like Brian. Yes. Brian cycles to work.
But you see, the thing is, our overall Malaysian diet now, the way it's evolved with our teh tariks, our nasi lemak, yeah. and so forth, it's a relatively unhealthy diet.
But it's not a new diet. I mean, my parents were eating nasi lemak yeah, right. when they Actually, were young. Yes. It's just that they did more things. They weren't sedentary. They weren't sitting behind a in front of a computer all day.
Absolutely. And they were not eating as frequently as we are. Well, that's true. Are having, you know, teh tarik in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, in the night, and then late at night as well. So, you know, that's a lot
supper,
of sugar.
Supper, all the mama supper, teh tarik sessions, right? It's coming up to 6:30 where we'll have these 6:30 news in about 5 minutes or so. But first, here's Lenny Kravitz with It Ain't Over Till It's Over. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Stevie Wonder there, Sir Duke. It's now coming up to 6:40 on Thursday, the 28th of September. If you've just joined us, I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez and Joyce Go this morning. A new study by HSBC looks at how much parents in different countries around the world spend on their children's education. So when it comes to investing in a child's education, it turns out that parents in Hong Kong spend the most. Okay, so they spend on average about $130,000 all the way from primary school to university. And if you look at who's next on the list, it's the UAE. Parents spend almost $100,000 on average, and Singapore mums and dads, they spend almost $70,000.
Well, where does Malaysia stand in this? Well, we are number 8, just after Australia and just before the UK. An average of $25,000, quite a lot of money.
Well, okay, I guess the question really is, right? Is this an extremely insane amount of money to be spending on your child's education? Or is there no limit to the amount of money that you would spend on your child's education?
I think as a parent, we always think about their education.
Sure.
That's right. a big part of when you have kids, you there's education and then there's like health and, you know, like they're happy, you know. But education is is at the top of the list.
Sure. So that means no expense spared.
Yeah, it depends. I think in Hong Kong, it's high because of the schooling there. And it's very competitive there. I understand that if you want to send your kid kindy already, they have like they have exams to attend.
To go to kindy?
Yeah. Yeah. You have to go for like an interview. You have an interview. You have to go meet. I remember my friend, her kid is 3. She had to bring her kid to go meet the principal. And there's this whole interview process. Not the parent and the principal, but the kid and the principal.
So like an audition.
And, yeah, yeah. So it's competitive. And I think in Malaysia as well, I mean, parents, education it's a big thing for us, right? You think about education, where to send our kids to school, what should we do, what syllabus to look at.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Brian? You're a parent as well.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, the Hong Kong experience is mirrored in Singapore. For some of the choice preschools or school or primary schools, or so, you basically need an interview to get in. And
you need to be Singaporean, right? Even like PR, you might not be able to get into some of the really top schools.
The really top schools, yeah, they have allocations in terms of citizens and non-citizens, and that's a fair thing. So, but the key thing is, and I agree with you, Joyce, as a parent, as an Asian parent, education for the child is of paramount importance. So a lot of times you tend to spend on, for example, because in our case, we have probably a mainstream education system that probably needs a bit of work. So a lot of us, myself included, send our children to international schools. Costs a lot of money, but we're willing to invest in it.
Right. Well, okay. I'm curious that you use the word invest, and I'm going to come back to that. But I'm going to cite an example. So the question here is, I completely agree with you guys that we should be, you know, no expense spared for children's education. But how do we fund it? So according to this survey, most parents use day-to-day income to help fund their children's education rather than longer-term investments and savings. And therefore, there's a trade-off, right? So do you spend money on your child's education, investing, and I'm using your word here, Brian, investing in your child's education, or do you save for your retirement later in life? So that there's that trade-off there. What do you guys think? Joyce?
It depends on what you want for your child. There's also this whole overseas, like later on when they go to uni.
Yeah.
The whole overseas education, whether or not you want to look into that, you know, that's an option, or you want a higher education here.
Locally, whether you want to send your kids overseas.
Yeah, that came up in one of the studies. In Singapore, a number of the parents send their kids overseas as well. And Singapore has one of the top universities, right? But they still send their kids, they want to send their kids overseas. Coming back to Brian's point, I would like to touch on, and when you talk about the national education here, yes, there are issues, but we can't totally write it off because, like for myself and I think Melissa, we are from the national education system. And I think we turn out okay. I don't know,
we came from the same school, so sample size quite small, I have to say.
It also depends on the school. The national education, yes, there are issues, but it also depends on the school and the teachers. There are top local schools here as well.
So here's the thing. Unfortunately, in a lot of ways, our local education system has gone backwards. I think it used to be a lot better before. And you've got a very good point, Joyce, because whatever you can send your kids to international school, and they are crappy international schools as well. I mean, it boils down to the teachers.
Yes, correct. And also the exposure. I have a friend that sends her kid to a private school, and she says that her kid is 7 years old, and he's coming back asking already for a handphone. And he says, oh, because my friend has a handful. So she says, these are the realities that you have to deal with when you send your kid to a private school.
It's the crowd that they're mixing with, right? Okay, I'm just going to bring us back to the survey because I did find one aspect of the survey completely surprising. Now, in India, Indonesia and Egypt, parents are, they're at the bottom of the list. So parents spend less than $20,000 on average on their child's education. But right at the bottom of that list is France. French parents were the lowest out of the 15 countries surveyed at just $16,000 per annum for the entire kindy to university. What do you guys think that is? It's a first world country.
It could be culture. Because, you know, there are books on French parenting, like bringing up
yes,
bébé.
Yeah.
And that there's this whole thing about bringing up your kids in the French way. And it's very different from the Asian way. I read the book and they actually tell you there's this whole pause moment. When a kid's crying, you pause. You don't, what happened? Why are you crying? No, you don't do that. You pause and you wait. You wait until I get to you. You don't cry. But in Asia, you're crying. Why? What happened? Or the pacifier fall down. Oh, faster take out and go and wash, sterilize. So it's very different.
So it's a cultural thing that parents don't feel the need to fund education.
There's also a financial reason for that. The state takes care of all your schooling costs.
Ah.
So you can go up to university as well, and essentially you pay a very minimal amount.
But that in Singapore, I mean, the unis are good, but the parents still want to send their kids overseas for uni. So I guess in France, maybe, like you say, the government pays for it, and I guess the French decide, okay, now you go to the uni there.
Correct.
Here.
Okay, so I have to ask the parents in the room here right now, is there anywhere you would draw the line for funding your child's education? Would you fund your child's education all the way up to master's and PhD? Would you encourage them to do that? Or would you say, okay, well, you've got the basics now, you know, you do the rest. What about you, Joyce?
I'm Penangite, so basics and yeah.
Basics and then you do the rest.
I'm into uni, I guess. but I will admit, education is a big thing on our minds for kids. I think for all parents.
So I'm also going to come back to what you said, Brian, about investing in your child's education. So if you invest in something, you expect a return, right? You expect ROI on that money. Now, if you're investing, say, $100,000 on your child's education, do you then as a parent expect that money to be returned to you in terms of taking care when you're older or having a say in what kind of job your child wants?
No, I think it's just about investing in the child, investing in developing that human capital. Now, one of the things, and you talked about drawing the line, I think you need to draw the line between spending the money and also retirement. So I hosted a Ringgit and Cent show last week with Felix Neo, Vice President of Client Advisory for Whitman, and Caitlin Ern of Loan Street. And what we talked about, we went through the loans, the life cycle of the child, basically from the before the child was born and then up to university. And one of the things that came out of it was really the fact that parents were not planning adequately enough for retirement, and many parents were funding their education month to month. So I would draw the line at that. I think retirement really has to be a priority.
Okay, well, that was a very interesting conversation. Now, I would recommend you listen to that. That was our Ringgit and Cents show last week, and you can find that on our BFM app. Just download it from our Apple App Store and Google Play. Joyce, what were you about to say?
Coming back to the point on investing in your kids, I think when you have children, it's very hard to think of ROI. Because, you know,
they are the
return. It's very hard to expect you never know. I mean, when you're old and whether or not, I mean, of course, you will hope that they'll take care of you, but you.
I think that's not a realistic scenario.
So we have to be realistic and just enjoy them now.
On that warm and fuzzy note, we'll be back with more news. After this, we talk job perks. And is there more to a job than a healthy pay packet? Stay tuned to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run, 6:52 right now. That was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers with Anything That's Rock and Roll. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Go and Brian Fernandez here this morning. And looking at a whole generation of job candidates, this new generation, they tend to want to join a company that offers them a good quality of life rather than just a healthy pay packet. So they look at the job perks and not just the salary.
Yeah, so the thing is, in terms of traditionally, you would think that, oh, okay, salaries make the bulk of your decision-making process. I joined a company with the highest salary. But the reality is, with millennials in particular, they look for other things. Job satisfaction comes from really flexibility. And also, for example, with startups, they give you extra incentives. So, for example, in startups like Airbnb, you get free holidays every year.
I don't think Airbnb can be considered a startup, given that it's one of the most valuable tech companies in the world.
Well, they
still
refer to themselves as a startup.
Startup culture, maybe.
Absolutely. So they get a yearly allowance of up to $2,000 to stay at any of its property around the world. Now, get this for the next super incentive. Unlimited paid holiday leave.
Ooh.
So people like Netflix, LinkedIn, and Virgin Management offer this as a perk. But it sounds bizarre, right?
Yeah. But wouldn't that dampen productivity? Wouldn't that mean less days at work, a few days at work?
Perhaps it's they you can apply for unlimited paid holiday leave, but whether that gets approved.
Yeah, but the thing
is, very practical.
But the thing is, so here's the flip side of the equation. So, writing for the World Economic Forum, emotional intelligence expert Dr. Travis Bradbury says freedom gives people a strong sense of ownership and accountability. So, like business owners, they actually end up taking no vacation at all. So it's very counterintuitive. I give you the flexibility to take as much vacation as you want,
mm-hmm.
but reality is peer pressure and your sense of ownership, then you don't take any at all.
Well, one of the job perks that I remember reading about and thinking, wow, this is really cool, was Apple and Facebook offering egg freezing opportunities for its female employees. Now, of course, we've heard so much about, you know, the female population or the ratio of female workers within the tech industry. So perhaps this is one way to attract more women to join the workforce and, you know, not penalizing them for deciding to join during their best childbearing ages.
Yes, and also it's a social issue because women, particularly in the tech industry, apparently tend to get married later in life because they're also more well-educated. And so this is a way to around that problem.
Is it specific to tech or perhaps just women nowadays that are...
Yeah, I think you're right. I think women nowadays in general, right?
But the idea of Facebook and Apple to offer this to their female employees is one that I found quite intriguing. Now, I do have to ask, you know, is it an equal trade-off? Do you would you pick a job, apples to apples comparison, would you pick a job that offered you better perks but a lower salary as opposed to a higher salary but with fewer perks?
It really depends. I think it also depends on where you are, at which stage of life you're in. You know, like perhaps if you have young kids, you want more time with them. Mm-hmm. As a mom, or maybe as a dad now, I have a friend who takes care of his kids full time,
but so, at the expense of, say, you know, less money to spend on the household.
Yeah, he doesn't work actually.
Oh wow! Yeah. Okay,
that's excellent.
Right. Yeah, what about you, Brian?
Well, the thing is, again, flexibility is very, very important. So, especially because of as Joyce pointed out, if you have a child. If you need to be really part of their lives, if you're working all the time, the traditional dad, you don't have time.
Okay, but let's contrast it with this startup in China, right? There's a startup in China that's trying to lure top talent, and they are just throwing money at talent. They've even, I think, offered a $3 million pay package.
Yeah, so this is a sign of changing times, because China, they do have a reputation of paying low wages and all that. So this company, Beijing ByteDance Technology Co., has this mobile app. It's best known for their mobile app called Jinri Tai Tiao, or Today's Headlines are in English, and it aggregates news and videos from hundreds of media outlets, right? And in 5 years, the app has become one of the most popular news services with 120 million daily users. So its founder says that he believes in unlimited salary for unlimited talent. Top performers can make $1 million USD in salary and bonus a year plus options.
Okay, so, yeah. Wow. All right. So really just kind of trying to lure the best talent by offering them whatever money you can get.
Yeah. But this is very specific, Melissa. At the end of the day, if you look at it, you know, he's looking at artificial intelligence experts, big data experts, which are in demand not only in China, but around the world. So there is really a war for talent right now.
Yeah, today it's a talent market. I mean, not just AI, but anywhere. If you have talent, I think employers want you, because if not, it's all about making sure you have the right talent in place to get the business running.
But you know, I mean, if you're being paid $3 million for your talent, essentially for a startup, doesn't that mean the company owns you? And I say owns you means it owns your entire life. Can you take unlimited holidays? You know, you would be at the company's beck and call. There's no way there's any downtime.
But isn't that the same if you're paid $3,000?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. When you're an employee,
so sad, Brian.
When you're an employee, you kind of, in a way, yes.
Oh dear. Okay, we've got the 7 o'clock news coming up in just a couple of minutes with Lynn Mark on BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. It's coming up to 7 minutes past 7 o'clock. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Brian Fernandez and Joyce Goh here with me in the studio, ready to catch you up on all the news you need to know as you start your day. Now, as speculation for the timing of GE14 or the 14th general elections continues, everyone's looking at youth as a key voter demographic, and that's become really a hot topic of scrutiny. So if you remember, last week, the Merdeka Center released a study on youth participation and attitudes towards politics. And what they found really was quite interesting, that youth are very disinterested and disenfranchised from politics, so much so that there's concern that many of them may abstain from voting.
The Election Commission said yesterday that fewer than 10% of the 30,000 university students approached have signed up to become voters. So, and among those who are registered voters, some of them, as you said, Melissa, are contemplating submitting a spot vote, undi rosa, or not show up as a means of making their point.
Yeah, so just as kind of a point of protest, right? So the EC, the Election Commission, is really looking at this. They've conducted programs to encourage university students or those in other higher learning institutes to vote during the elections. We spoke to Chairman Tan Sri Muhammad Hashim Abdullah, and he cited several reasons for voter apathy among the student demographic.
Kita turun ke universiti, kita jumpa budak-budak 18 tahun. Berbagai-bagai persepsi dia terhadap pendaftaran tu sendiri. Pertama, dia kata dia tak tahu. Yang kedua, dia kata tak tahu nak daftar mana. Yang ketiga, dia kata dia tak nak terlibat dengan politik. Yang keempat, dia kata undi dia satu ni tak bawa makna apa-apa pun. Sebab tu kita ada SPR memperluaskan dia punya tanggungjawab, iaitu dengan cara satu lagi program, how to educate these people.
That was Election Commission Chairman Tan Sri Muhammad Hashim Abdullah. And his point about, you know, young people thinking that maybe their vote is just one vote out of many, maybe makes no difference to the current political situation. That could be a kind of key or a core reason to the voter apathy we're seeing among the young.
I think that's one of the aspects of it. But potentially also the other aspect is really about how politically aware our young people are. Are they even bothered about it because they're more interested in pressing matters like, you know, making a living and so forth? Now, these are students at this stage of the thing. But youth, really, what about the youth who are not students? They're worried about bread and butter issues.
Well, we also spoke to Thamalingam Pillay, director of Undi 18, a youth group campaigning for lowering the eligible voting age from 21 to 18 years old. And we asked him if he knew many people who would choose to cast ballot votes?
Not typically, to be honest. Generally, what I see is that people, especially people in my age group, I'm 24 years old right now, there are those that are very politically involved, but there are also the other side of the field, people who really aren't involved in politics, people who don't pay attention. And then you have this, I would say, a significantly smaller chunk who are very much politically knowledgeable. That means they follow politics, they are involved in activism, and these people believe that their protest vote would mean something. So I wouldn't say this is a lot, but I'd say that this is a minority of my friend group.
Okay, so there are people who will opt to do to cast protest votes. But, you know, I'm trying to wrap my mind around this, why someone would bother to wait hours in line to cast a protest vote. I mean, what possible message would they be trying to convey?
Yes, I don't get it as well. Perhaps for them, they just want to make their point. But what point is that?
So that's exactly what we asked Tharma as well.
Based on my conversations with them, they want to express their dissatisfaction with both sides. They feel like they don't really have a proper choice or a genuine choice. So that's how they want to convey their dissatisfaction or their anger at the system, that there isn't much of a choice for people like them.
So we also spoke to him and asked him if protest votes have a potential to make any kind of meaningful difference that is desired. Just as the EC chairman was saying, maybe some of the youth voters think that perhaps their one vote doesn't really make a difference. So we put that question to Tharma and asked him if there were any international examples.
Okay, firstly, I think it depends on a country-to-country context. In the case of like certain developed democracies, like for example in the UK, protest votes had a huge impact, especially in Brexit, where people thought of the referendum as a sort of protest against David Cameron, because they thought, okay, no one is going to vote against EU, so let's do some sort of protest vote as not against EU but against the government. And in the end, their votes contributed to the UK having Brexit right now. So they have been successful, not in pushing their own cause, but sort of like working against their cause, ironically enough. But I would say in the case of Malaysia, I don't believe that it would make much of a difference, because I think that your protest vote, especially if you are aware and you are like active and you are like very knowledgeable about the political situation, I think your protest vote is a vote for status quo. It doesn't change anything. And this means that whether you write, oh, screw politics, or I don't like either side, or no racism, it doesn't matter what you write on your ballot paper. The end result is your ballot paper will be pushed aside because the electoral commission only wants to see or only wants to count who voted for Barisan Nasional or who voted for Pakatan. They aren't really interested in seeing this minority or this few thousand of accidentally spoiled votes or purposely spoiled votes. So maybe maybe depending on a country-to-country basis, protest votes might make sense. But I would say in Malaysia, no. Protest votes or spoiling your votes is a futile, invisible protest.
Well, there you go. Okay, that was some strong words there from Tharman there. Brian, what do you think? I mean, he did say that a protest vote means a vote for the status quo. We've had some commentators saying, yes, research shows that this is the case. Protest votes only work in mature democracies.
But also, let's look at it from a numbers perspective. If you're in a marginal seat and you're casting protest votes, that could swing the outcome dramatically. And particularly in Malaysia, where the percentage of the popular vote in is such that, in fact, the opposition may be the one that has more opportunities to win votes if, say, the younger people get in. And cast their votes, a protest vote would really be a negative.
Will make a difference. So I'm just going to quote something that I read, a comment made by a political analyst called O.I. Sun from the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies. And according to their research, that by not voting in a two-party electoral system, essentially you're ensuring victory for the ruling party, which has more financial wherewithal to organise mass voter turnouts in their favour. Now, coming back very quickly to Tamalingam Pillai from Undi 18, we also asked him, what he would do, how he would persuade protest voters to exercise their right to vote.
For protest voters, what I've been trying to do personally is I've been trying to convince them that in a country like Malaysia, protest votes aren't a very meaningful thing. Like, you spend your time taking, 1-2 hours just to vote on election day, taking time off work, wasting your own personal time, your petrol. The result must be something tangible. That's what protests are about. But if you don't achieve something, why bother doing that protest vote? You might as well try to do something meaningful and beneficial.
That were the thoughts of Tamalingam Pillai, director of Undi 18. It's 7:15 now, and we're going to be back with a look at what's on the front pages of today's papers. So stay tuned to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.